Thanks so much for that beautiful prelude, Ruth and Rosemarie. Good morning, and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Mary Mullen, a member of the program committee. Prairie aspires to be both an open-minded and an open-hearted congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic background, religious background, whatever your color, your sexual orientation, your gender, your family structure, and we also welcome you no matter what your abilities or your inabilities. Later in the service, we'll invite any visitors or guests or returning friends who haven't been here for a while to introduce yourselves, because we really want to get to know you better. On Sunday, we provide a wide variety of services, and they're presented either by a Prairie member, as is true today, a member of the wider community, or our minister, Sandra Ingham. Today, Robin Proud will be doing our service on Harriet Martineau. We do have a few announcements, and I'm going to invite Kathy Converse up here to make the first one. This is unusual. Usually I just read them all.
I didn't want to subject her to this announcement. You want a room painted, your dog walked, you like marmalade, dinner with friends, a canoe ride and picnic, acting in a play, barbecue in January, a sip of liquor, your picture taken, an evening of music, learn to make a mole, homemade soup, popcorn and charades, that hanging gutter reattached. Then come to the Prairie March 10th auction and bid, and all donations can be sent to me. And I also have this notebook. It will be out on the front desk out there if you haven't yet sent it to me or emailed it to me. Thank you.
And I have one other little notice here. It says Rose, that would be Rose Smith, says it's okay to sit on her chair in the front window while she and Galen are away. In other words, we need someone to sit out there and greet visitors. Okay. For other announcements and so on, look at this column in your order of service and also on the back. Our opening words will be read by Anne Lundeen, and this is a responsive reading. She'll read the first part.
This is in the hymn book, page number 436, but it's also in your program. Please join me with this responsive reading. We come to this time and this place. To renew our faith in the holiness, goodness and beauty of life.
To reaffirm the way of the open mind and the whole heart.
To rekindle the flame of memory and hope, and
to reclaim the vision of an earth made fair with all her people one.
Thanks, Anne. Let's now turn to our first hymn, number 138. These things shall be, and stand as you wish.
Thank you.
don't know how many of you noticed that that music came from 1789. So we're connected to the past. Please welcome Kate and Brian up here to light our chalice. Oh, Luna too, great. And the words for this are, flame of fire, spark of the universe that warmed our ancestral hearth, agent of life and death, symbol of truth and freedom, we strive to understand ourselves and our earthly home. Let's have a moment of silent meditation. Now invite children and parents to the front of the room for our children's story, which will be shared today by Al Nettleton.
To all of you.
Good morning.
Once there was a little girl. She lived about 200 years ago. Her name was Mariah. She was full of questions. When she was two, are any of you two? You're older than two, huh? Oh, you're two. Okay. She asked questions like, what? What was that? And what is this? And what are those? And what are these? Her parents answered as best they could. That's a dog, and this is a cat, and well, those are the dog's whiskers, and these are the cat's toes. Her parents gave her lots of answers, but she always had more questions. When Mariah was three, are any of you three? Yeah.
I'm four.
She had more questions. She started to ask how. How does this work? How does that happen? How do we know how it goes? And her parents tried to answer as best they could. Boiling water makes steam, and steam pushes the lid on the tea kettle, and we know, well, we know because we do know. And how Mariah wanted to know. How do you know? Well, because we look at it and we wonder and we do experiments and we find out answers. We can do experiments too. When Mariah was four, we have any four-year-olds here?
Me.
Yeah, all right. She started to ask why. Why do boats float? And why does it get dark at night? And why do cars have fur? And why do people wear clothes? Her parents tried to answer as best they could. But no matter how many answers they had, Mariah always had more questions. She asked questions at home. She asked questions at school. She asked questions at the Quaker church where her family belonged. She asked questions of everyone she met. Hundreds of questions, thousands of questions, millions of questions. And she got, well, in fact, she had an infinity of questions from that little girl. Let me find my place. Mariah had the infinity of questions, and she loved the infinity of the stars. In the evening, she and her father would climb the stairs to the top floor of the house in Nantucket by the sea, and they would climb up a ladder to get to the roof. On the roof was a small platform with a railing around it. They call those a widow's walk. From the top of the house, Moriah could see far out to sea, and far above her, she could see all of the stars, thousands of stars, millions of stars, an infinity of stars.
How did she see you? All the stars
yeah. behind her. And one little girl, I love stars, she told her father, and they would look through a telescope to see further into the sky. Then Moriah would start to ask questions. Where do stars come from?
Oh, no.
How old are they? Why do they shine? How many are there?
1,000.
How far away are they?
Beyond the moon.
Oh, and beyond the moon. Some questions her father could answer, some he could not. So Moriah set out to find the answers all for herself. She studied hard and read many books and did experiments, and she became an astronomer, a person who studies the stars. When she was 29, she discovered a comet, which was named the Mitchell Comet, after her. The King of Denmark gave her a medal for discovering that comet. And in 1848, she became a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which had never had a woman member before. But Moriah was still full of questions. How do we know God exists? Is it all of the Bible true? And why are we here? And some people gave her answers, but when Moriah asked, how do you know? They answered only, because we do. Or because we read it in a book, and so that's the way it is, and we shouldn't ask anymore. Moriah didn't think those were very good answers at all. But the answers to her questions weren't to be found in books or by doing experiments, so Moriah kept asking. One day she heard a talk by a Unitarian minister named William Ellery Channing. He didn't have the answers either, but he said that there was room for an infinity of answers to the infinity of questions, and the important thing was to wonder, not to know. So Moriah decided to join the Unitarian Church because those words woke up her mind. All through her life, Moriah Mitchell asked what and how and why. She became a teacher so she could help other people answer their own questions. And in 1865, she became a professor of astronomy at Vassar College, and she taught other people about the stars. Sometimes they found the answers to the questions. Sometimes they didn't. But Moriah Mitchell was happy either way, because the most important thing is to wonder, not to always know. So let's sing the children downstairs.
Farewell, good friends, farewell, good friends, farewell, farewell. Till we meet again, till we meet again, farewell, farewell.
As a caring community, we now take time to share special joys, sorrows, and personal concerns with our prairie friends. Wait for the mic, and please keep your comments short because we probably have a lot.
I have a card. To send to Rose and Galen, or to it says to Galen if you want to add a note to Rose Smith, that would be fine too. They are at home, and anything special to report, Susan?
Nope, they're just hanging in there.
They're hanging in there. Okay, thank you.
Yesterday, February 23rd, was my 86th birthday. Also the birthday of George Frederick Kendall. Monday, I go to a senior lunch group, Lahayim, where it's a place where George and I, in the Ethnic Connection, gave a music program for many years. And there's an article about me from the Madison Jewish News back there on the
Just add, both of my children were born on the same day, too, 1 year apart. Another birthday. But they are now 63 and 64.
It was a joy on Friday night to hear Mary and Judy and Rick read their stories along with several other people at the Meadowood Life Story Writers event at Sequoia Library. And this morning I emailed the link to the recordings to Prairie Views. If you didn't get to the event, you can listen to them online.
I always love the UU Open Confessional because everyone still loves you. I haven't been here lately on Sundays just simply because I've been working and tired and lazy and don't get up in enough time to get here, but I'm here today and I'm very happy to be with all of you. And possibly soon in the near future, I may not be able to be here because my schedule is changing. I may have to be at work earlier on Sundays. But I also have a joy that I don't want to jinx it, so I'll just say that without naming any names, I have an interview with a local natural foods cooperative on Tuesday for a full-time baker. So I'm really excited about this. You can't see my goosebumps, but they're underneath my sweatshirt. So thank you so much for being here and loving me and loving each other, and it's good to be here today.
For all those joys, concerns that haven't been expressed, I'll light this final candle. Now it's time for us to welcome guests and visitors. So if you are here for the first time or haven't been here for a long time, we invite you to introduce yourself and say what brought you here today.
I'm very happy to have my daughter with me today. For those of you who don't know her, she's the young lady sitting
there. Well, thank you. I'd like to now introduce our speaker, Robin Proud. She didn't give me a bio, but most of us have known her for quite some time. I can't remember how many years they've been coming here, but many. Robin is a very good speaker. She's been in Toastmasters for many years, and we always look forward to her presentations, usually about different women connected to Unitarianism. So, Robin Proud.
Good morning. Well, I'm very glad to be here. It's probably not the best idea to have scheduled this and then go away on a trip to Texas, although it was wonderful in Texas, returning last night, and there was a chance at one point that I might have still been in Atlanta, or perhaps I would be here but my speech, which was in the suitcase, would be there. That wouldn't have stopped me. I call this my series, intermittent series, on famous UU women we've never heard of, because it's amazing. If you look at the pictures out by the restrooms, there's a poster of famous UUs. And although there are also some men that we may not know much about, like William Ellery Channing or Theodore Parker, we tend to have heard their names. But with some of the women, the names do not even ring any bells, even among those of us with multiple college degrees. So for anyone who wasn't here in the past, it all started when I gave a presentation on Margaret Fuller, who was America's first feminist, had a wonderful life. Now, thanks to the internet, you can look her up, any of these women up on Wikipedia, and the UUA site will come up if you Google these names, so it's a lot easier to find out about them than it used to be. Then I also did a presentation on the Peabody sisters, Elizabeth, who owned the first bookshop owned by a woman in the U.S., also started kindergartens in the U.S. Her sister Mary, who married Horace Mann and got him interested in education, which he wasn't particularly interested before. And her other sister Sophia, who married Nathaniel Hawthorne, whose career was going nowhere before he met those women. And they also had a lot of influence on some of the Unitarian thinkers of their time. And then there's a group of women that we know, but they've been reduced or prettified, like Louisa May Alcott, who was talked of as just a sweet lady who wrote books for children, which was not at all who she really was. So there's a lot there. It looks like I might have to do the next one on Mariah Mitchell. So we do have a couple of pictures here of Harriet Martineau from a bit younger and older age. She was famous for a lot of her life, so we have more pictures of her than many of these women. She lived in England from 1802 to 1876. So this is around the same time as the other women I spoke about, but those were Americans. She was in England, although as you'll see, she visited the US. She was a prolific writer. She wrote 35 books and many articles and essays, and they were on a wide variety of topics. She was able to support herself with her writing in a time when only a few women could do so. And generally those who did were the Brontes or George Eliot. They were writing fiction and sometimes not under their own name. She wrote in so-called masculine fields, economics, politics, religion, medicine, and the emerging field of sociology. She's considered one of the first sociologists. She traveled widely and knew all the leading figures of her time. So I'll just tell you a bit today about the circles in which she moved, some of her views on religion and politics, her writing, and her travels. Harriet's family was relatively well off. Her father was a textile manufacturer in Norwich. They were of French Huguenot ancestry, and they belonged to the Unitarian Church. The sixth of eight children, Harriet wrote that her mother had not given her affection and approval. So like some of these other women, like Margaret Fuller, for instance, Harriet had learned to read English and Latin early in life. She was educated by tutors and by her older siblings, and she also attended two Unitarian schools. Some of her earliest articles were about education. At age 21, she wrote, "We find that as long as the studies of children of both sexes continue the same, the progress they make is equal. After the rudiments of knowledge have been obtained, the boy goes on to continually increase his stock of information, while the girl is probably confined to low pursuits. Her aspirings of knowledge are subdued, and they are and thus before she is sensible of her powers, they are checked in their growth. And when the natural consequences of this mode of treatment arise, all mankind agrees that the abilities of women are far inferior to those of men." That is, when the girls had less opportunity for education, then it was judged that, of course, they were not as intelligent. And women like her who had the education were able to disprove that. Fortunately for Harriet, at age 15, she went to stay with an aunt whom she found much more nurturing. This was in the town of Bristol. And this aunt introduced her to an inspiring group of people, including a Unitarian minister, Dr. Lant Carpenter. When Harriet was 24, her father died, leaving the family in poverty. Around the same time, a brother died and her fiancé. Although this must have been a difficult period for her, Harriet later was glad she had never married. She wrote, "There has never been any doubt in my mind that considering what I was in those days, it was happiest for us both that our union was prevented by any means. I am in truth very thankful for not having married at all. I have never since been tempted nor have suffered anything at all in relation to that matter which is held to be all important to women, love and marriage." She felt that that kept her free to lead her life, which could be true, that certainly a husband might not have approved of her travels and her writing. Once she became known for her writing, Harriet moved to London, where she associated with many leading figures, including Thomas Malthus, John Stuart Mill, George Eliot, Thomas Carlyle, and Elizabeth Barrett Browning. She also was greatly admired by Erasmus Darwin, the brother of Charles. Charles himself was on his famous voyage to the Galapagos, but on his return, he was concerned that Harriet would be too radical a sister-in-law. However, when he met her, he wrote, "She was very agreeable and managed to talk on a most wonderful number of subjects. I was astonished to find how little ugly she is." "But as it appears to me, she is overwhelmed with her own projects, her own thoughts, and her own abilities." Erasmus palliated all this by maintaining one ought not to look at her as a woman. And since she didn't want to get married, that was probably fine. In 1835, Harriet toured the United States, where her Unitarian connections gave her an introduction to William Ellery Channing, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and James Madison, among others. At that time, she met Margaret Fuller, who was about 8 years younger. And Margaret, who was self-educated, wanted to make a life for herself as a writer on serious subjects, so she was very inspired to meet a woman who was already doing this. However, her friendship with Margaret Fuller had a stormy path, and you'll have to bear with me on this because I've researched some of these people. It's just so delightful to see how they meet each other, and people were not any different in those days. Sometimes this was a small group, and I said sometimes it is a bit like high school. The relationships among these folks are a small town. When they met in 1835, Margaret was 25 and Harriet was 8 years older. Margaret was writing articles and she hoped to write a biography of Goethe, and so she was encouraged to meet this other woman who was supporting herself by her writing, and they had similar educational backgrounds and unhappy childhoods, but they had very different personalities. Margaret was romantic and spiritual, Harriet was practical and decisive. So when Harriet went back to England, and she published two books about the United States. In one of them, she criticized the methods of the Temple School. Now, we've heard about this with some other folks. Bronson Alcott opened a school, and his belief was that children already possessed truth and morals, and a teacher just needed to bring it out. In some ways, this was very good because he didn't believe in beating children and forcing them to memorize. So both Margaret Fuller and Elizabeth Peabody taught at that school at different times. Harriet did not agree with these methods, and she said that this philosophy was mischief and would create falsehood and hypocrisy. So after that book came out, Margaret Fuller criticized Harriet's book for a want of soundness and of habits of patient investigation, and deplored the crude and temperate tirade you have been guilty of about Mr. Alcott. And so they had this rupture for some time. Harriet got in the last word by writing in her autobiography some years after Margaret had already died. The difference between us was that while she was living and moving in an ideal world, talking in private and discoursing in public about the most fanciful and shallow conceits which the transcendentalists of Boston took for philosophy, she looked down upon persons who acted instead of talking finely. While she and her adult pupils sat gorgeously dressed, talking about Mars and Venus, Plato and Goethe, the liberties of the Republic were running out as fast as they could go. Now, it is true that Margaret Fuller was not involved in, say, abolitionism in the extent that Harriet was. She felt that everyone should be very supportive of that cause. But Harriet Martineau was never present at any of these conversations, which took place often at Elizabeth Peabody's bookshop, by the way. Her remark about how they were dressed was taken from someone else's report. And it is true that Margaret Fuller, toward the end of her life, became very involved in politics and in the Italian Revolution, and certainly did much acting of her own. But it's not surprising that two larger-than-life figures could not always see eye to eye. So let me tell you a bit about Harriet's writings. Harriet's first essays were for the Unitarian periodical, Monthly Repository. In fact, she became its most frequent contributor. But this wasn't enough to support her family. Out of her family's poverty, Harriet created her career as a writer. Many options were closed to her because of her illnesses, which I'll tell you a bit about later. But writing is something she could do from her own home and in her own time. The first time she earned money for writing was when she entered an essay contest. The Unitarian Association actually sponsored three contests. There were three different topics to write on. One was to prove how Unitarianism was superior to Judaism, and the next, how it was superior to Catholicism, and the third was how it was superior to Islam. So from this we see that Unitarians were no more modest at that time than they are today. The essays were to be submitted anonymously. Then they were not all judged at the same time. Harriet felt she might as well compete for all three. Her research included reading the Quran, which was very unusual at the time. She had the essays written out by three different people because, of course, they would have all been done in handwriting. And she sent them in from different locations. And when the judging was over and the authors were revealed, it turned out she had won all three prizes. So this encouraged her to pursue writing as a career. She claimed that she never revised or edited, that she just wrote, she thought deeply and then wrote out all her works. She was most famous for a series that she started in 1839. These came out in some sort of pamphlets or stories called Illustrations of Political Economy. It was to teach people to understand concepts like tariffs, taxes, national budgets, and so on. It took quite an effort to find a publisher. She spent a lot of time going to different publishers with this, but the series was an instant hit. It seems to have been the Freakonomics of its time. That is, it was popularizing these ideas. Now, these were areas not well understood by the public, and especially not written of by women. So because of her success, she then became quite famous and entered a period where she said she was lionized in London and got to meet all these famous people. Some of her other writings were after her tour of America. She wrote two books based on her travels. And in America, she actually covered over 10,000 miles, met many people, and she praised American democracy, but she felt that women should have a more equal position. And she was a fervent abolitionist. More about that a little later. She also wrote a book called How to Observe Morals and Manners, which has been called the first textbook of sociology. And she tried out her theories by how she observed in the United States. She explained, when one studies a society, one must focus on all its aspects, including key political, religious, and social institutions. Now, these might seem obvious to us, but there really was no science of sociology at the time. I have a few of her observations of America which are frighteningly relevant today. It is hard to tell which is worst, the wide diffusion of things that are not true or the suppression of things that are true. The systematic abuse with which the newspapers of one side assail every candidate coming forward on the other is the cause of many honorable men who have a regard to their reputation being deterred from entering public life, and of the people being thus deprived of some better servants than any they have. The worship of opinion is at this day the established religion of the United States. Influence which is given on the side of money is usually against truth. And a queen or a prime minister's secretary may be shot at in London, as we know, and probably there is no person eminent in literature or otherwise who has not been the object of some infirm brain or another, but in America the evil is sadly common. So this was in around 1840. Some of her other works were about education. One was called Life in the Sick Room, which was based on some of her own experiences as an invalid, and it offered the shocking idea of the patient helping to direct her own care. Later, she traveled to the Middle East, and she wrote a book called Eastern Life, Present and Past. She also wrote The History of the 30 Years' Peace, 1816 to 1846, in 1849, when it barely was history. She was very ambitious in the number of subjects that she took on. She wrote one novel, Deerbrook. So for those of you who enjoy George Eliot or Elizabeth Gaskell, you may also like this book. It's really the only novel that she wrote, and although it's not autobiographical in any story sense, it must represent some of her views. The frame story is a little bit like Middlemarch. There are two young women, a sensible one and a flighty one. A young doctor marries the flighty, self-centered one, and then he wonders whether he's made a terrible mistake, which is kind of the story of Middlemarch, too. Some of her elements are remarkable. I think she has a very good portrayal of children who act like children, which is quite unusual in this Victorian time. And her psychological monologues are very interesting. And her description of the small town village life. There's a wonderful villain in the story. It's the busybody woman who has been running the town and who resents the influence of the newcomers. Now, some parts of this novel do seem a bit too pious, and it's rather hard to believe that when hard times come, the selfish young bride becomes thrifty, steadfast, loyal, brave, and all those other Boy Scout things. It's probably much more likely she would have said, "It's all your fault. I never should have married you," but instead she improves. Another thing that's interesting is there's a teacher, a character of a teacher who is an invalid in the book. In this case, it's because she was in an accident. So she talks about what it's like to be outside of society because of her health, and that had to reflect in some way some of Harriet's views. In all, Harriet wrote 35 books and many essays, translations, opinion pieces. She did not find writing for a living to be a hardship. And if I've heard other writers say this, what she said here was, "Authorship has never been with me a matter of choice. I have not done it for amusement, or for money, or for fame, or for any reason, but because I could not help it." So I'll say a little bit about her illnesses. She felt that illness defined her life. I don't know what the cause was, but early on she lost much of her sense of taste and smell and hearing. She used an ear trumpet. So she had some hearing. And late in life, she said that deafness was about the best thing that ever happened to me. She felt that people were more likely to really come and speak to her and confide in her because of this. She certainly didn't let it slow her down. From 1839 to 1844, she suffered from severe pain, and we do not know exactly what this was. She took opiates, which didn't stop her from writing. But then she underwent mesmerism, which is hypnotism. That was a new treatment. And she was delighted to find that her pain had vanished. She became a fervent advocate of this new advance in medicine. So we don't know whether her problem was psychosomatic, whether she had some sort of tumor or cyst that happened to move and reduce the pain. But since she had this newfound enjoyment of life, she traveled and wrote for 11 more years. Then in 1855, at the age of 53, she was diagnosed with heart disease. Thinking she wouldn't live long, she published her autobiography, but as it turned out, she lived over 20 more years. And at one point she wrote, "Doing pretty well for a dying person." You can find her autobiography online. It's wonderful. The whole thing is there if you Google her, and it's got kind of a facsimile of what the original one looked like. She has great detail of memory of growing up, of when going to London, meeting all these people, of all her experiences in the United States, and it's all available, and she was an excellent writer. I'll give you a little bit about her views on religion. She grew up Unitarian, and her brother, James Martineau, became a well-known Unitarian minister. Her early writings were for the Unitarian publications, but as she aged, she moved farther and farther from the church. Her trip to the Holy Land convinced her that religion had evolved through men's interpretations, rather than being divinely revealed all at once. She felt that as humanity developed, it came to understand the divine more and more as an abstract concept. So she gave up traditional views of God or the afterlife, to the point that her brother James felt compelled to write a scathing review of her book. They never spoke to each other again. And toward the end of her life, she wrote, "I hope and believe my old co-religionists," that's the Unitarians, "understand and admit that I disdain their theology in toto, and that by no twisting of language or darkening of its meanings can I be made out to have anything whatever in common with them about religious matters." So she may not have been happy about being featured in our famous Unitarians. But I did choose some readings and hymns today that seem to be more in the humanist vein, which I think she would have approved of. Another quote she had on religion: "For above 30 years, I have seen more and more clearly how awful and how irremediable, except by the spread of a true philosophy, are the evils which arise from that monstrous remnant of old superstition, the supposition of a self-determining power independent of laws in the human will. And I can truly say that if I have had the blessing of any available strength under sorrow, perplexity, sickness, and toil during a life which has been anything but easy, it is owing to my repose upon eternal and irreversible laws working in every department of the universe without any interference from any random will, human or divine." So she seemed to be saying that the laws of nature were comforting to her, and she felt that that was strengthening as opposed to any sort of divine intervention. She also had one quotation about finding that her happiness was not always linked to her circumstances, that at times that could be very trying were sometimes times that she was very content. And I'll tell you a bit about her political views. Before going to the United States, Harriet had already written criticism of slavery. She was surprised that abolitionism was not further advanced in the 1830s, and that so many society notables were cautious, and then they warned her against the radicals. She said, "We were constantly and gravely informed, as a matter of fact, that Garrison and his followers used incitements to the slaves to murder their masters." So this sounds like something we get on the news today, right? That William Lloyd Garrison is a rabble-rouser, they're trying to murder white people, and that they were sending agents and publications into the South to effect insurrections. And what she found out was Garrison and most of his followers were non-resistance and thoroughly consistent opponents of physical force. But because she didn't know this at first, she said it was, these charges were totally and absolutely false, but it was really impossible to remain wholly unimpressed by them until she had learned more. I steadily declared my intention to hear, when opportunity offered, what the abolitionists, as well as others, had to say for themselves. But it certainly never entered my imagination that I could possibly find them the blameless apostles of a holy cause, which I afterwards saw that they were. That is, she had heard so many negative things about the abolitionists, but when she got to know them and what they stood for, she felt that they were totally in the right. At a society home in Philadelphia, the following incident occurred. I saw my companion look embarrassed and could not conceive why, till the lady turned full upon me with, "Can it be as your friend assures me? She says that if any young person known to you was attached to a Negro, you would not interfere to prevent their marrying." I replied that I had no notion of interfering between people who were attached, that I had never contemplated the case she proposed, but that I did not believe I should ever interfere with lovers proposing to marry. The lady exclaimed against my thus edging off from the question, which I had not the least intention of doing, and she drove her inquiries home. I therefore replied that if the union was suitable in other respects, I should think it no business of mine to interfere on account of complexion. The lady cried out in horror, "Then you are an amalgamationist." Harriet had not yet heard this term, but once she understood it, so apparently this was a term for intermarriage, she countered that obviously there were relationships between blacks and whites, as could be seen in the presence of the many mixed race people in the South, and apparently the only relationships that were not accepted were those that were legal and blessed by the church. Her host warned her that she would not be received in many houses with her views. But she continued to travel, covering over 10,000 miles. And she did stay at homes in the South. After she came back and wrote about it, some people said she had taken advantage of Southern hospitality, only to criticize her host in the book. But she countered that she was well known as a slavery critic from her previous writings. These people knew who she was, and in fact, they took her in to convince her of the rightness of their way of life. She practiced her new discipline of sociology, because she recommended observing them dispassionately. And for instance, she wrote, "It must be remembered that the greater number of slaveholders have no other idea than holding slaves. Their fathers did it. They themselves have never known the colored race treated otherwise than as inferior beings, born to work for the whites, helpless, improvident, open to no higher inducements than indulgence and praise, capable of nothing but entire dependence." And then she talked about how they tried to persuade her how their plantation, for instance, was different. "I was heartsick of being told of the ingratitude of slaves and weary of explaining that indulgence can never atone for injury, that the extremest pampering for a lifetime is no equivalent for rights withheld, no reparation for irreparable injustice. What are the greatest possible amounts of finery, sweetmeats, gratuities, and kind words in exchange for political and social and domestic existence, for body and spirit?" Now that last comment, when she says the extremist pampering is no equivalent for rights, and what are great amounts of finery and sweetmeats in exchange for political and social existence, also applied to women. Now she certainly saw that the magnitude of slavery was much different than the issue of women, but she was the first English woman to write about the position of women in the United States being in some ways similar to the position of slaves. She wrote at one point that a mistress was better off than a wife because she could leave a cruel man and the wife couldn't. About America, she said, "There is no country in the world where there is so much boasting of the chivalrous treatment she enjoys. In short, indulgence is given her as a substitute for justice." And at one point, she had this quotation, "Happiness consists in the full employment of our faculties in some pursuit." And when I read that, I thought of the 50th anniversary of the Feminine Mystique that has been talked about much, that she felt that women should be able to employ their brains and energies in the world. Harriet constantly upheld the rights of women. She actually gave credit for her idea for the political economic series that what made her so famous. She gave credit to another woman who had come up with the original idea. She certainly supported other women's causes. She admired women who were active in the world, such as Florence Nightingale. She recommended education on all types of subjects for women. She was way ahead of her time in demanding equal pay, not necessarily for the same work, but for equivalent work. For instance, dairy maids who milked cows, strained milk, made cheese and butter, should be paid as well as men who did similar types of labor. She wrote, "On the female side of the lunatic asylum, the largest class but one of the insane are maids of all work, the other being governesses. The causes are obvious enough. Want of sufficient sleep from late and early hours, unremitting fatigue and hurry, and even more than these, anxiety about the future from the smallness of the wages." Another Downton Abbey fantasy shattered. The maids and governesses were not happy. And if these women avoided the asylum, they still could end up in the workhouse in their old age, as there was no way to save money. Now, Martineau did not advocate government programs. She was considered a laissez-faire, free market type of economist, but she felt that these women should receive higher wages and a chance to invest money. When Harriet was 52, she wrote to all her correspondents asking them to address her as Mrs., not because she had married, but because the title accorded her more respect. So this is the same tradition that meant that the cooks and housekeepers in the great houses, like Mrs. Hughes, were always called Mrs. whether they were married or not. And she felt that this indicated a degree of respect. So that's really the same sort of drive that led to the introduction of Ms. in the 20th century. The women's suffrage campaign didn't really get started until after Harriet's lifetime, but she did write in 1865, "I have no vote in elections, though I am a tax-paying housekeeper and responsible citizen. And I regard this disability as an absurdity, seeing that I have, for a long course of years, influenced public affairs to an extent not professed or attempted by many men." So she maybe was not modest, but this was true that she had been involved in political and social circles for some time, and yet she had no vote. So this is just a brief introduction to Harriet Martineau. As you heard, she did many things. She was a great thinker and writer, regardless of gender, and all the more remarkable for the handicaps women at that time encountered. One of my previous talks, I used this quote, "Ginger Rogers did everything Fred Astaire did, but backwards and in high heels." Well, in a sense, that's what women were facing. There was no higher education available, except what a woman could get on her own or through a tutor. There were no careers as such, and she had to overcome all these beliefs that women were not as intelligent as men or could not achieve. Women had to make extra efforts to acquire knowledge and to be taken seriously in careers and in contributions to society. So we as UUs are fortunate to claim these outstanding women in our history. And if we have some questions or comments.
Thank you so much, Robin. I so enjoy the way you bring these
historical women to life, make us care about them and feel them in this room. I wanted to ask you said that she pulled away from the Unitarian Church. Was the Unitarian Church then much more kind of traditionally theocratic and more not the kind of Unitarian church that we have today?
That's my understanding. Someone here may know more, Sandy, or someone else may know more about this, that although they were liberal, they, for instance, she said that they didn't believe in the miracles, but they still were much more traditionally Christian than we would see today in a lot of our churches. And so it was not accepted to be an atheist and be a member of the Unitarian Church.
I apologize for throwing in the irrelevancy, sort of, but Something you said very early struck me, because my wife Pam, who's not here today, is her story, but I won't tell it because she's not here. She was taking care of our grandson Joseph when he was about 4 or 5 years old. He was, also was taken care of sometimes by my first wife Carol. And he looked at her and said, "You know, Grandma, you're less ugly than Grandma Carol."
Oh. Well, it was interesting that Darwin had to make that remark. You know, certainly if this had been a man, Darwin wouldn't have commented probably on the person's appearance at all. But and there was that. Certainly, Harriet had the same kind of reaction that Margaret Fuller got, that someone like Eleanor Roosevelt got. Oh, she's not really a woman. She's ugly, and her personality isn't feminine. There was always that judgment.
I'm proud to add to my descriptors that I'm an amalgamationist.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, I have a practical question. These various essays that you quoted from, were they published in newspapers or magazines? I know they didn't have that much publication in those days, but there were newspapers. Some of which we know. Would you know some of them?
Yes, she did. She did write for newspapers. I'm sorry, I don't have that, but I can look that up. She wrote for newspapers. She wrote for these periodicals, and then some of those were quotations from books. For instance, the ones on the United States were from the two books she wrote about her travels. But again, because she was famous during her lifetime, a lot of that can be found, and. Some of the quotations and so on are available online.
Yeah, I had a question. You have two pictures up there, and I don't think you described who they were. So, and I probably should know who's one or the other. But
These are both her at different
ages. Oh,
they
are both her. Okay.
Now, Mitchie had a good question about whether one could be that the later one was from a photograph. Earlier on, there probably would have been too early for photographs. So there are quite a few images of her because she was famous from early on, as opposed to some of our folks who we were lucky to find one. But The one on your left is, I believe, is from a painting. Might be a bit more flattering, but the other one also was quite a bit later in life.
I may have mixed up between your presentation and what she was saying, but what can you tell us about her humor? And then I've got another comment.
Well, Ed, that's hard to tell because everything that comes through me becomes humorous, but...
that's my problem, yeah.
But it did seem that she was rather witty, some of these things that she said, and sometimes they may be, you know, it also might be humorous for us to hear some of these views about slavery, for instance, which at the time was, of course, very serious, but to see how things have or haven't changed in the United States as a little different viewpoint that we have.
Because I could see her kind of as a Borat character traveling through the South.
Yeah, I'm sure she was, well, she really made an effort to be a sociologist and to observe people dispassionately. Oh, this is what they said about slavery, and this is how they, all the things that they explained to her, and she learned from that.
Oh, well, my comment is about a woman that I did a program on, Caroline Norton. And I seem to remember that Harriet Martineau thought very poorly of Caroline Norton. And perhaps it's because Caroline, had kind of one issue, and that was that women should be able to have rights to their children rather than the man to have rights to the children only. And Caroline was more just really involved in the kind of the social life of her period, and she was very witty also, but the two of them did not mesh.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Probably not too surprising, though, that...
Sounds like she sort of had a low opinion of almost everybody but herself.
I kept forgetting during your talk that Harriet lived in England for most of her life. And I wondered, was there much cross-pollination between the women's suffrage movement in England and America And did she? She seemed to be ahead of her time in the abolitionist, or the abolitionist movement was fairly early on when she visited America, right? And what kind of influence she had on that movement?
Yeah, I don't know that she influenced the abolitionists, but being able to write about that for the folks back in England, I mean, they were certainly devoted to their cause. I don't know that she swayed any other Americans who were not already supporting it. As far as the women's movement, it was getting going. One of the last things she did toward the end of her life, there was a bill that said it was about women's health, but what it really meant was that if any woman was walking alone, she must be a prostitute. Mm-hmm. And so a number of women combated that, and that was an issue that it was more likely to be lower class women who were being targeted, but it was more of the middle and upper class women who took on this project of defeating these laws that were supposed to be safeguarding the streets in the Victorian era. But she was a little bit before there was really a large suffrage movement. She died in 1876. I'm sure that the English and Americans did have some conversations because that was going on at the same time, and someone here may even know more about that.
I wanted to, my wife and I went to a speech by Ray Camillay last week on the history of slavery from Roman times down to the present day. And he said many things. It was a very interesting speech, but the one that might be pertinent here, some of the questions, he said that the anti-slavery movement arose in Britain in reaction to the American Revolution, that they became very critical of what was going on in the United States, because they were angry at the United States for having broken away. And that was a real incentive for them to criticize it.
Well, that's interesting. So on the other hand, some in England wanted to support the South during the Civil War in order to keep getting cotton.
Yeah, just an added quick footnote on the subject of slavery. In the 1820s and 30s, slavery was actually dying out in America. And it wasn't until a fellow from Connecticut named Eli Whitney came up with the cotton gin that the economics of cotton growing changed. Slavery went on the resurgence. And it's also important to know that among the forefront of the abolitionists, although this is seldom covered in history texts, were immigrants from Europe after the revolutions in 1848, most particularly German Americans, and this is reflected highly in the German language newspapers at the time. They were very important in advancing abolitionism.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
Now's the time for our offertory, and the ushers will pass the baskets at this time. Just please pass them back to the ushers, and we'll hear from Ruth and Rosemary, one of my favorite songs, Star of the County Down.
Excuse me, please. I'm still having a problem with my finger here. Okay.
Thank you.
please turn to our final hymn, number 313, Oh, What a Piece of Work Are We? Closing words are on reading number 559. Now follow if you like. From Emma Goldman. Someday men and women will rise. They will reach the mountain peak. They will meet big and strong and free, ready to receive, to partake and bask in the golden rays of love. What fancy! What imagination, what poetic genius can foresee the potentialities of such a force in the life of men and women? Please, thank you all for coming, and please extend the hand of friendship to those around you and join us for a conversation. Thank you.